This is Taking Aim, a weekly show hosted by David Hensley and Stephen Woodward. Join us for open season on hypocrisy, deception, woke culture, and uniparty cronies. We'll review the stories you might have missed and prepare you for what's to come in the week ahead. Taking Aim starts right now.
Good morning, everybody. Welcome back to your favorite Saturday morning program, heard exclusively here on WEEB. I am Steve Woodward. Thanks for joining us this morning. We would be remiss if we did not mention our faithful and loyal sponsors. The Marketplace Restaurant and Catering since 1980, your go-to for fabulous breakfast and lunch choices, as well as a very reliable catering partner, whether you're hosting a small intimate gathering or the wedding of the century. The Marketplace Restaurant and Catering. And our newest sponsor, We the People Declare, an organization of like-minded citizens who are watchdogging Pinehurst specifically and Moore County more generally as very engaged citizens. We the People Declare, now part of the Taking Aim team. As we do each and every week, we are going to cut right to the chase and introduce you to our public enemy number one, numero uno. And boy, this week the choice was pretty clear. I didn't have to have a lot of meetings to discuss the public enemy number one candidates because this guy jumped right to the top of the list. He is Tomas Escoto, and he is a member of the United States Secret Service. Now, we talked a lot about the Secret Service in the summer of 2024 when a greasy-headed, scraggly kid on a roof tried to shoot Donald Trump's head off, and we learned as a result of that incident that the Secret Service assigned to Trump's campaign was... dare I say it, not necessarily the best and the brightest available to protect him. But there's been a lot of reform in the Secret Service. But, you know, these guys fall through the cracks. And we do have now a Biden-era Secret Service officer, Tomas Escoto, who is assigned to the detail of Vice President J.D. Vance. Well, Escoto is at a restaurant and... a young woman who apparently he found somewhat attractive and appealing began chatting with him. He did not know, however, that she was there as a stealth undercover reporter for the James O'Keefe Media Enterprise. They specialize, of course, in capturing candid interviews where people say the quiet part about things out loud. And often share information that they're not supposed to share or tell the truth about something for a change. So the gentleman, one of the gentlemen assigned to the Secret Service detail of Vice President J.D. Vance, Tomas Escoto, is chatting away in a restaurant. Play clip one.
Tomas Escoto is often directly involved in the Vice President's transportation to and from his residence at the Naval Observatory, surveillance of the Vice President's residence, and even protecting Vance's wife, Usha Vance, and their children. Here he complains again to a total stranger he just met about his assignment involving J.D. Vance's children.
So what are his kids like?
What school?
Oh.
Yeah, we follow them everywhere. There's a 24/7, there is no lack of coverage. Not like it's a babysitter, but it's a weird one that we always talk about, like, what the fuck is this? But you can't do nothing.
Oh, you can't do anything.
No, we can't do anything.
Tomas proceeds to give our undercover journalist detailed info with pictures about the specific methods used to transport and protect the vice president. Here's a picture that Tomas sent us taking off from Joint Base Andrews Air Force Base. You see the convoy vehicle going into the airplane, and some of these photos even had location metadata baked in the photos. It's worth mentioning that these pictures were taken a few months prior to sending them to our journalist. While they didn't give away the vice president's location in real time, they did give away certain routes that were used and the number of vehicles in the convoy, information which could be used in the future. This is a photo Tomas sent us from King Khalid International Airport in Saudi Arabia. Here's a photo Tomas sent us loading the convoy into an aircraft at Munich Airport in Germany, where Vice President Vance gave a speech to the Munich Security Council. Again, metadata there on the photo. For the trip to Tennessee, the Secret Service agent also texts our journalist informing her which plane the vice president will be traveling in and when they plan to depart. He even texts her an image of himself in the plane, notifying her that he is on board with the VP. And even worse, Escato continues to detail Vance's future travel plans, revealing at the time that Vance will be visiting his home in Ohio for 4 to 5 days, and then will be visiting Florida for one night. Now, this is potentially a violation of the non-disclosure agreement that Tomas would have signed when joining the Secret Service, which states, quote, the unauthorized disclosure, unauthorized retention, or negligent handling of classified information by me could damage or irreparably be injury to the United States or could be used to advantage by a foreign nation, I hereby agree that I will never divulge classified information to anyone, unquote. And it may also be a violation of federal law. 18 U.S. Code 793, gathering, transmitting, or losing defense information. Now, in some Section D, it states, lawfully having possession of photographs related to national defense and communicating or transmitting them to any person not entitled to receive them shall be fined or imprisoned, not more than 10 years or both. It's important to note that the Secret Service could not confirm that the behavior exhibited by Tomas violates these laws, but they did say they are potential violations of the United States Secret Service Code of Conduct.
Well, I would say that Tomas is toast at this point. I cannot imagine a more egregious violation of what he signed up to do. I suspect that He may have a little Trump derangement syndrome. And, you know, after all we've been through with the Secret Service and its shortcomings during the Trump campaign, now we have Trump 47 and his vice president, J.D. Vance. And hopefully this will be another wake-up call internally within the Secret Service that, you know, that they've got to vet these people a little bit more closely and keep him... people like him from going into restaurants and yapping about what they do for a living. It shouldn't really even be divulged at all, in my opinion, really. Well, speaking of divulgences, a most alarming report this week from A.P. Dillon at the North State Journal, one of the few investigative journalists with credibility in the entire state of North Carolina, in my opinion. Here's what she uncovered with the help of our excellent Republican North Carolina state auditor. A required financial statement audit of the North Carolina Education Lottery released near the end of 2025 by the Office of the State Auditor describes a revenue increase, but a decrease in the amount amount transferred for education spanning the 2024 and 2025 fiscal years. So in other words, more money than ever before is being raised through the education lottery in North Carolina, but the amount that is going to education is declining. Says the auditor, Dave Bollock, over the last 3 years, total revenues have increased by a total of over $3 billion while contributions to public education have been flat. How is that possible? The entire lottery was created many years ago, 2005 to be precise, to fund North Carolina's public school infrastructure and system. But here's the bottom line. The financial report shows the education lottery reported total annual revenue of $5.4 billion for 2024 fiscal year. Of that total, $1 billion were net revenues for the Education Lottery Fund. So their net is $1 billion. Okay, revenues increased the following fiscal year from 5.4 to 6.6 billion, but the amount sent to the Education Lottery Fund dropped to 1 billion. So 5 billion and then 6 billion coming in, and a fraction, we're still talking about billions, but where's this money going? I'm wondering if a Somalian is going to turn up as being part of this North Carolina Education Lottery. So here's what happened. When the law was enacted in 2005, it specifically required that at least 35% of the revenue was to be transferred into the education fund. However, Democrats, during negotiations over a 2007 budget bill, switched the requirement into a guideline, saying that 35% should probably, in most cases, be sent to the education fund. So what happens? Here it is. Over the years, the percentage going to education has not been maintained, and that issue has been noted by the state auditor, which says in the past 3 years, the percentage has gone from 23% to the education fund in 2023 to 20% in 2024, down to 16% the last fiscal year of 2025. So this story bears further investigation, because where's the money going? Is it just a big slush fund? And we know that despite the infusion of these billions of dollars into the education system, it certainly has not driven a spike in reading and math proficiency, which continues to be woefully inadequate for most students, to the point where many of them are going off to college and they're so non-proficient in math and reading that universities are forced to include in their freshman curriculum remedial courses to bring them up to speed. Thank you very much. What a great system that is. And that's why homeschooling has never been hotter. All right. We also, tell you who the public enemy number one is, but then we quickly segue to public embarrassment number one. And man, I tell you what, I could say that this guy qualifies pretty much every week. Senator Tom Tillis of North Carolina. He went on a little rant this past week on the floor of the Senate up there in Washington, D.C., where he basically accused his fellow Republicans, both those who are elected and members of the Senate, and you and I, by extension, of being not very intelligent. He is very upset about discussions ongoing about the United States and its relationship to Greenland. And he's also still obsessed with reminding us over and over again of how close the country came to being overthrown on January 6, 2021, when he claims, still to this day, that he and all of his colleagues were a heartbeat away from being savagely murdered by you and I, people like you and I, who were at the Capitol on 6 January 2021. Let's hear what lame duck and very lame Senator Tom Tillis has to say about these topics. Play clip two.
Miller said that the U.S. government... obviously, Greenland should be part of the U.S. That is absurd. We have to go back and take a look at the relationship to Greenland. And why am I coming to the floor, a senator from North Carolina? Because since 2018, I have been the Republican leader for the Senate NATO Observer Group. I've gone to every NATO conference. I've gone to the Munich Security Conference. I've met with almost all of the leaders of the countries who are part of the 32-nation coalition known as NATO, the North Atlantic Treaty Alliance Organization. Now let's talk about why I think it was an amateurish comment and something that a deputy chief of staff and senior policy advisor should not have taken the position on. Number one, he doesn't speak for the U.S. government. He speaks for the President of the United States, and on that basis, he can. But when he says that the U.S. government thinks that Greenland should be a part of NATO, he should talk to people like me who have an election certificate and a vote in the U.S. Senate. Some people around here call me cranky. I've got a couple of buddies that call me cranky. You know what makes me cranky? Stupid. What makes me cranky is when people don't do their homework. What makes me cranky is when we tarnish the extraordinary execution of a mission I fully support in Venezuela by turning around and making insane comments about how it is our right to have territory owned by the Kingdom of Denmark. Folks, amateur hour is over.
So then after Senator Tillis goes off on Stephen Miller, Donald Trump's senior policy advisor, on the topic of Greenland, which, you know, the Trump administration has a way of, I should say, inflaming emotions, because it takes on topics head on. And Greenland has a very legitimate geopolitical purpose for the United States of America, and it's worth exploring that. You know, Tillis seems to think that everything has to be belabored over in a congressional hearing, and in some cases that's appropriate. But this is merely a opportunity to talk about the geopolitical significance of Greenland vis-a-vis the security of the United States going forward. That's all it is. It's a discussion worth having. Then he segues into what I mentioned earlier, his ongoing misrepresentation of the events of 6 January. Specifically, he's been pushing to have a plaque formally displayed in the U.S. Capitol building honoring the law enforcement on hand on 6 January 21, protecting congressmen from this insurrection, as they like to call it. He uses the narrative of the left in describing January 6th, which is absurd. We know, for one thing, that National Guard troops were declined by Nancy Pelosi deliberately. We also know that a couple of hundred, at least, federal agents were implanted, embedded in the so-called mobs that went into the Capitol that day, that freezing day in Washington. And yet, Tillis wants to talk about this January 6th plaque as if we should all be demonizing the reason that people showed up at the Capitol that day. And I have no problem with honoring law enforcement, but this plaque simply advances, in my opinion, a false narrative about what actually went down on 6 January. Let's hear from the senator on that topic.
But more than 5 years later, the plaque has not found a permanent home on Capitol Hill. The delay is owed, in part, to House Speaker Mike Johnson, whose office says the law is, quote, not implementable because the law called for a tribute to law enforcement members, while the plaque itself honors whole departments rather than individual officers by name. North Carolina Republican Senator Tom Tillis paid tribute to the actions of law enforcement on that day, calling it a wonderful stress test for democracy.
We heard thousands of people storm this Capitol. People died. Police officers were injured, hospitalized. One died shortly after January the 6th. A lot of people said that was a dark day for democracy. I would leave you with this. It was a great day for democracy because of the law enforcement officers, the people that kept us safe, because you know what we did when confronted with thousands of thugs storming this building? We took a brief recess. We got ourselves together. The Capitol was secured, and before we left this compound, we came back and completed our constitutional duty to certify the election.
You know, in case you missed it last week, because I know we're all busy getting back into our routines after the beautiful Christmas season, a few things happened that we need to talk about. The Pinehurst Village Council has now seated its two newly elected members, Fitzpatrick and Hooper. And at its meeting to kick off the year, it also honored the service of outgoing council member Jeff Morgan, a very fine man, Jeff Morgan. I've known him for a number of years. He is a military veteran. He is a staunch conservative. He has served the village council well, very well, as a matter of fact. He's been a voice of reason in the face of a lot of topics that, you know, drive us all crazy because of the council's tendency to overreach, specifically in the area of short-term golf rental properties. So they honored Jeff Morgan with a plaque. There's another plaque coming up in our dialogue here, in his final meeting as a member of the village council. And as I said, I really admire and respect Jeff Morgan. But this has been a year, keep in mind, in Pinehurst, when many business owners have been compromised by a totally botched stormwater infrastructure repair project that was supposed to last for 6 weeks and has gone on for basically the entire calendar year of 2025 and is still to this day not totally completed. So you have a lot of really ticked off business owners, rightfully so, who have been communicating with members of the council their displeasure with the council's indifference toward the fact that they've been losing money and customers because of this ongoing construction project awarded to what is clearly a unqualified contractor. And so they're not happy about it. Unfortunately, Mr. Morgan decided that he needed to go out with a bit of a lecture directed toward the citizens of the community. Let's play clip three.
They are currently serving. They may make 25 cents an hour. It's a big commitment, okay? And so whether you like them or not, I want you to respect them. I want you to respect what they're doing for you, okay? And I'm going to give a little chastisement here. Don't want to let this escape. I don't do much on social media, never followed it, but trust me, I've got people that do, and they would present stuff to me about what's on social media. There are some trolls out there, is what it's known, who say vile things. I got no problem if you disagree with me politically. Actually, I don't really care if you say something vile to me. It bothered my wife. But what I don't like seeing is that when people were serving you back here, and then you get on social media and you become a troll and you get character assassination, they probably not doesn't bother them too much because you don't get in this role if you've got thin skin. But their family might. And the only person that looks bad is the person putting it on social media. So if you are one of those very few people, and I'm sure it's nobody in this room here, and it may get out. I got no idea what Matt's going to write there. But if anybody watches this, let me just tell you my personal opinion. The only person that looks bad on that is the troll that's putting it on there, and that you should be ashamed of yourself, and I'm sure your parents are. Let's try to raise the whole conversation to be professional, treat each other with decorum, and respect what's going on here. So that's my ask of you.
Well, you know, generally I don't disagree with that, but again, the suggestion, the inference that the village council is above criticism when merchants in our village have been basically trampled upon by a slipshod project going on for months and months on end, I think a little bit of emotion may be in order in that particular case. But anyway, we will be following the newly seated village council and see what its hobnail boot tactics will be like for short-term rental property owners going forward, and many other topics as well, I'm sure. The gender madness that we're seeing unfold in Minneapolis. And what do I mean by that? Well, it's becoming obvious that a lot of the hysterical folks who are taking on ICE agents, one who lost her life by weaponizing her vehicle to strike an ICE agent on a Minneapolis residential street. We're seeing that that these people may just be using ICE as a way to deal with their own mental illness. Here's an interesting point of view by an author who goes by the pen name Armageddon Prose. Armageddon Prose, kind of a ominous sounding name. But here's the conclusion of this person, and I think it's worth considering when you're wondering about these crazy people protesting, and they're mostly, you know, angry white women. Armageddon Prose writes, in a perverse inversion of social hierarchy, victimhood, and oppression in the modern liberal democracies of the West, counterintuitively, we confer higher rather than lower social status. Oppression, or perceived oppression, is social currency, and every social climber wants to cash in. Unfortunately, for the white women of the middle class and the upper Midwest, demand for oppression greatly outstrips supply, which is an economic dilemma. So any opportunity, no matter how flimsy the pretext, to claim victimhood status for oneself, or, as often happens, to claim it vicariously through the real or imagined suffering of more legitimate oppressed minority groups, is considered golden and must not be squandered. So there's the social angle. But the anti-ICE Karen phenomenon runs much deeper than mere social striving. There's a psychological element that no one in respectable society wants to talk about, which is that victimization and oppression is a source of sexual titillation for huge swaths of the female population. That is quite a conclusion, and when you think about it, it makes a lot of sense, because what else, at the end of the day, explains the unhinged crazy that we're seeing, not only in Minneapolis, but in other parts of the country? You can't make this up. We're going to take a break here to acknowledge our sponsors. We'll be right back.
Hey, it's Luke Black, proud owner of The Marketplace. Since 1980, we've been your neighborhood sandwich shop. We're open Monday through Saturday for breakfast and lunch. If you're craving a fresh sandwich, salad, soup, or a hot cup of local roasted coffee, we've got it all made fresh daily. The Marketplace can cater your next event, from small office lunches to full wedding parties. You can rent our space for private gatherings after hours. You can find The Marketplace at 246 Olmsted Boulevard in Pinehurst. It's not just a sandwich, it's an experience.
This is Jim Nash, small business and homeowner in Pinehurst. Recently, a number of Pinehurst citizens have seen the need to form a new initiative called We the People Declare. Website, wethepeopledeclare.com. We support citizens who value freedom, ethical governance, and community integrity. We will ensure our governance faithfully serves the public's interests, maintains open communication, accountability, and transparency. Get involved. Visit wethepeopledeclare.com and sign up to stay informed.
We are back. I'm Steve Woodward. This is Taking Aim. Let's continue with this week's riveting programming. And we're going to turn our attention to the ongoing crazy in the state of Minnesota, the land of 10,000 lakes and 10,000 flakes. So here's what's going on. We know that in Minneapolis-St. Paul, where they have a mayor named Jacob Fry, who is sort of like an evil version of Mr. Bean, a very pathetic character. We know that in Minneapolis-St. Paul, There's basically this kind of civil war going on between Immigrations and Customs Enforcement Agents, ICE, in a city where they have a lot of ice this time of year, in terms of the weather. And it's ICE versus all these citizens who seem to be unemployed with, but have cars and cell phones driving around seeking to impede them, even as they're rounding up some very dangerous illegal immigrant criminals. However, there is some good news. There are other places in Minnesota where normal seems to be entrenched. In the community of Rochester, Minnesota, which is its own city, nothing to do with Minneapolis-St. Paul. Rochester, Minnesota, actually the home of the famous Mayo Clinic, one of the most famous medical facilities in the world. It's so famous that foreign dictators fly there when they become ill to be treated. Rochester, Minnesota, ICE agents are present there too, maybe to a lesser degree, but they've encountered a little different environment there in Rochester. Play clip four.
Here's a woman who didn't grow up being an idiot Democrat and doing drugs and wasn't deprived of oxygen at birth. And she had just come from a store where there were a bunch of ICE agents in the store in Minnesota, but not in Minneapolis-St. Paul, not in Rochester, but outside of Minneapolis-St. Paul and outside of Rochester. Woman went into a store. There were a whole bunch of ICE agents in there. What happened?
You know, I love the suburb I'm in. So ICE was just in my suburb at our local grocery store while I was there, and they were grabbing somebody. Nobody in the grocery store stopped them from doing their job. Everybody was clapping and excited about ICE being there. People were hooting and hollering, you know, chanting for ICE. You gotta love small towns in Minnesota, honestly. We are so stoked. And honestly, you know what I did after the ICE agents got done with their job and what they were doing? I said, can I buy you all, you know, like something to drink, something to eat? And I did. And I sure did, because you know what? I'm excited that ICE is in Minnesota. Really excited.
Even nice Midwestern, middle-aged women use the F word in every sentence now. It's kind of an amazing thing, like schoolgirls do. Because, and I put the blame for that on the Democrat Party as well. Just extraordinary. But how great is that? She's in a grocery store. She doesn't want to say where she is because, you know, the rioting lunatic mental cases. And ICE agents came into a grocery store. She's in the grocery store. And what happened? They were grabbing somebody who is, you know, probably a serial murderer in their home country. Or maybe I was reading from the list of some of the people that they arrested just in the last few days in Minnesota that the Democrats are out there protecting with their very lives. And the Democrats, they want more crime. They want more murder. They want more mayhem.
That's Chris Plant, by the way, who shared that story with us, who is heard on WEEB Monday through Friday, 9 a.m. to noon on this very radio station. But that's great. That's actually some good news that there is some normal out there. People who actually understand the proper role of these federal law enforcement agents, and their goal is to make their communities safer. Think about that. I mean, we have a story, again, another Charlotte story, Charlotte, North Carolina, that has come to the fore. Two teenage guys were murdered 5 days before Christmas, and we're just now learning about the detainment of the assailant. And again, this is a county where the sheriff willfully pushes back against cooperating with ICE and has said so publicly and is proud of it. Two lives lost now to this illegal immigrant thug in Charlotte. And again, it's just like collateral damage to these people. It's like, well, you know, we can put up with a few murders as long as we don't appear to be racist in going after these illegal immigrants. It is such warped and twisted logic that the more you talk about it, it just makes your blood boil. And believe me, my blood is usually simmering at most of the time anyway. I don't need any boiling to further my demise. But all right. There was a hearing in the august halls of the U.S. Senate in the past week in which Missouri Senator Josh Hawley, a little hard to say, Josh Hawley, you have to enunciate carefully. He was interviewing a so-called subject matter expert in a hearing about regarding matters related to abortion. And, of course, the left continues to believe that women should be able to freely elect to have abortions of living fetuses whenever they feel like it. And we call that murder, those of us on the right side of this argument. There's a reason we're called the right, because, you know, we're right, okay? So Senator Hawley is interviewing this little weaselly word salad person, and he asks what seems to be a very straightforward question, but here's the answer. Play clip five.
Why don't we just start there? Dr. Verma, I wasn't sure I understood your answer to Senator Moody a moment ago. Do you think that men can get pregnant?
I hesitated there because I wasn't sure where the conversation was going or what the goal was. I mean, I do take care of patients with different identities. I take care of many women. I take care of people with different identities. And so that's where I paused. I think, I wasn't sure where you were going with that.
Well, the goal is just the truth. So can men get pregnant?
Again, the reason I paused there is I'm not really sure what the goal of the question is.
The goal is just to establish a biological reality. You just said a moment ago that science and evidence should control, not politics. Absolutely. So let's just test that proposition. Can men get pregnant?
I take care of people with many identities, but
can men get pregnant?
I take care of many women that can get pregnant. I do take care of people that don't identify as women.
Can men get pregnant?
Again, as I'm saying,
let me just remind you what you testified to a moment ago. Science and evidence should control, not politics.
Absolutely.
So, can men get pregnant? You're
totally
a doctor,
agree.
I think.
Science and evidence should guide medicine.
Do science and evidence tell us that men can get pregnant? Biological men, can they get pregnant?
I also think yes/no questions like this are a political tool.
No, yes/no questions are about the truth, doctor. Let's not make a mockery of this proceeding. This is about science and evidence, and I'm asking you. You know, the United States Supreme Court just heard arguments yesterday at great length on this question. This is not a hypothetical question. This is not theoretical. It affects real people in their real lives. And you're here as an expert, called by the other side as an expert, and you've been telling us that you follow, right, you're a doctor, and you follow the science and the evidence. So I just want to know, based on the science, can men get pregnant? That's a yes or no question. It really is, I think.
I think you're trying to reduce the complexity of a lot.
I'm not. I'm trying to get, it's not complex. I'm trying to get to an answer, and I'm trying to test, frankly, your veracity as a medical professional and as a scientist. Can men get pregnant?
Answer the question. Sir, have you no decency? Reminds me of Dr. Fauci during the pandemic. I am the science. I am the science. And Roy Cooper, then governor of North Carolina, we're going to follow the science. That's what we're going to do. So wear your mask and stay home. Anyway, that was such a delicious soundbite. It ran a little long, but it's really couldn't resist including that in this week's lineup of crazy. Meanwhile, we were talking about Minnesota. You think all the fraud and abuse with the Somalians is going on in strictly in the state of Minnesota? Unfortunately, you would be wrong about that. Here's a report by investigative journalist John Solomon, which came across the transom this week. Homeland Security Department officials have told Just the News, which is the name of his information collecting journalistic digital platform. Homeland Security Department officials say that TSA officers tracked and flagged about $136 million in bulk cash in outbound luggage at passenger checkpoints at John Glenn Columbus, Ohio International Airport going back to November 2023. The cash movements, wouldn't we all like to have more cash movements in our life? I for one would. They're nice when they're moving in your direction. The cash movements were made by U.S. citizens of Somali origin, you don't say, who flew out of the Columbus airport en route to either the airports in Minneapolis or Atlanta. And the couriers always declared the cash as legally required on documents that they were asked to submit. Oops, sorry. Had a little mid-air turbulence there. Typically, says one official familiar with the investigation, typically when they go to Minneapolis, they drop off the cash, and then a subsequent courier travels abroad from Minneapolis to Dubai through Amsterdam. Wow, think of the frequent flyer miles. The officials said they appear to have uncovered a massive cash movement operation that gathered money from multiple Somali immigrant communities in the West, Midwest, and South that eventually brought luggage filled with currency to Minneapolis for flights overseas. So you see here, folks, if you think this is a Minnesota fraud situation with Somalia, Minnesota is merely the conduit, is merely the mothership of this whole thing. It's going on everywhere. And wait, just wait until we start looking into what the fraud in California, which, you know, is certainly, given its population size, much more adept at hiding fraud than a state like Minnesota. The report goes on to say that the cash movements out of Minnesota's largest airports were 90 to 99 times larger than the total amounts moved out of major international airports like JFK International in New York or Seattle and Atlanta. Senate Homeland Security Chairman Rand Paul of Kentucky, Republican Kentucky, says he is launching an investigation to see if the exports of cash were tied to the fraud. Here's what Rand Paul says. He says the Somalis were so good at it that they were sending hundreds of millions of dollars back overseas. So I think we are at the tip of the iceberg. Meanwhile, Governor Tim Walz, who has, you know, been running for vice president and doing other lefty things while this is all going on, and now claiming that he had no idea. Well, he may still be facing his comeuppance. While Walz has vehemently denied wrongdoing and insisted he did not turn a blind eye to the fraud scheme that federal prosecutors say could reach $9 billion, three GOP Minnesota state legislators told Congress last week that there were more whistleblowers in state government willing to come forward to chronicle their efforts to alert the Walz administration to fraud and the subsequent retaliation they endured. So I think Tim Walz is going to end up in an orange jumpsuit, but that's just me. Of course, his running mate for the White House, Kamala Harris, who is running for president of the United States, and of course lost in dramatic fashion to Donald J. Trump. She's not wasting a lot of her free time nowadays worrying about Somalian fraud or the murderous illegal immigrants who are roaming our homeland that came in while she was vice president of the United States. No, you know what she's doing? She's shopping for real estate in Malibu, California, and she and her husband, Dougie Emhoff, found themselves a 4,000-square-foot little bungalow on the beach in Malibu, California, for which they stroked a check for $8 million, ladies and gentlemen. It is good to be a corrupt Democrat, and Kamala Harris is really, really, really good at it. And thank God, every day on your knees, that that she is not president of the United States of America. We talk a lot about education, and we've got a big school board race coming up here as we enter primary season, early voting beginning on February 12, believe it or not. And we're going to be talking on this very program to the Republican candidates for one of the at-large seats, of which there are four, running for two seats. So that's a bit unfortunate, but And also, you will be told repeatedly that these are nonpartisan races for school board. That is the biggest load of crap that you will ever be fed. Nothing could be more partisan than school board races, at which we have come to learn in recent years, especially during the pandemic when we learned just how intense the indoctrination efforts of the left are in public education and how intent school board members are in protecting those efforts and allowing not only American history to be distorted, but allowing pornographic and very sexually graphic filth to be on the shelves of public school libraries. Fortunately, we were able to root out a lot of that here in Moore County. But Mississippi, does that come to mind when you're thinking about educational excellence? Well, it should. According to a report in the Wall Street Journal, Mississippi is leading the way on public education reform. Jason Riley points out that a Gallup poll last year revealed that satisfaction with public education had reached a 24-year low. Okay, but there's good news for the folks in Mississippi. Successful education, public education models do exist, and one of them is down there in the southern state of MISSISSIPPI. They've made such an impression that even the New York Times has a report on it. The conventional wisdom, Riley writes, long ago advocated by the Times editors and other liberals, is that poverty largely explains learning gaps and that more school spending will result in better educational outcomes. Not. Yet Mississippi, which spends less per student than almost every other state, is outperforming other states with far larger education budgets. Adjusted for state demographics, Mississippi ranks first nationally in fourth grade reading and math and at or near the top in eighth grade reading and math, according to an analysis by the Urban Institute. Among black students, Mississippi ranks third nationally in reading, and its low-income students outperform all other states. How, asks Jason Riley, did the Magnolia State pull it off? According to the Times, it did not do so by relying on some of the most common proposals held up as solutions in education, like reducing class sizes or dramatically boosting student funding. Rather, Mississippi pushed through a vast list of other changes from the top down, including changing the way reading is taught in an approach known as the science of reading, but also by embracing contentious school accountability policies other states have backed away from North Carolina. Last week, the Mississippi House of Representatives took up a bill that would loosen limits on the creation of new charter schools and make it easier for families to transfer from one public school to another. So again, another domino falls in a good way toward public education reform in Mississippi, where instead of demonizing charter schools, they're embracing them. In addition, the legislation would create education savings accounts that allow parents to direct education dollars toward private schools or homeschooling if traditional public schools aren't meeting their children's needs, which in many cases is quite often. The teachers' unions oppose school choice, but like other changes the state has made, it has a proven track record of success, especially for low-income minorities. Unfortunately, too many states are hampered by teachers' unions, and even in a state like North Carolina, where the unions do not actually hold sway over the teachers in that they're not forced to join them, but too many states are hampered by these unions, which pursue their own interests at children's expense, and they're hampered by an education establishment that thinks that social crusades are more important than basic skills. Perhaps, Jason Riley concludes, a few more Mississippi miracles will help expose the left's deceptions. Boy, wouldn't that be nice. And we can start that right here in Moore County by electing the right folks, starting with early voting on February 12th, And concluding with Election Day on March 3rd, we have a really early primary in North Carolina, which is a topic for another day. But by the way, if you're not registered to vote, this is a good time to figure out how to get that done, because that's your first step toward being a responsible citizen. And then, of course, you can start voting at designated early voting locations on February 12th, which will be here before you know it. And that'll go on for like 17 days. And then the final weekend of February will come and go, and then we'll vote on Election Day, Tuesday, March 3rd. And as I said, there's a whole big roster of people running for these two at-large seats on the school board, but there are only four Republicans, and they are, in no particular order, just as they come to my little feeble head, David Norris, Jim Peterson, Olivia Oxendine, and Don Zawlaki, also known as Coach Z, by the Z, by the Z, by the beautiful Z. So we'll talk more about these school board candidates and other races coming up. And I did want to mention, we were talking about Tom Tillis earlier and what a knucklehead he is, and that he's a lame duck not seeking re-election. And Donald Trump has said publicly that the reason he's not seeking re-election is because he's tired of being on the wrong side of so many issues that Trump 47 is advancing. And that's probably true, by the way, because most of the things that Donald Trump says are in fact true or proven to be true later on. But we do have a race for a U.S. Senate in North Carolina, and there is a primary. And I want to apologize, because I think on a recent show, I fell into the trap that everyone else does by saying it's a showdown between the Democrat, former Governor Roy Cooper, and the front runner on the Republican side for U.S. Senate, Michael Whatley, the former chairman of the Republican National Committee, and before that, the chairman of the North Carolina Republican Party. But it is not a showdown in the primary between those two. In fact, Don Brown is a very capable and eligible and qualified Republican running for U.S. Senate. I would check out his social media and his website. For any of you who have heard him speak, he is the real deal. Also, Michelle Morrow, an education reform advocate, also a very capable individual, has put her hat in the ring. I hate that cliche. I shouldn't have even gone there. Has joined the fray, and is a candidate for U.S. Senate in a primary that has many candidates in it. But don't be distracted by the numbers. Seven candidates in the U.S. Senate primary. But anyway, nothing wrong with Michael Whatley. He'll be able to raise a ton of money. Don Brown, however, from a ideological standpoint, I think is more rock-ribbed and a little bit more authentic as a conservative Republican. I think I can say that I've talked to Don. I've gotten to know him. And then, of course, Michelle Morrow, who ran for Department of Public Instruction superintendent last fall and was defeated by the big lefty Mo Green, who, as far as I can tell, has done nothing to improve public education. Okay, we know about Zoran Mamdani is the mayor of New York City. Already people are taking notice of what that's going to mean. Play clip six.
Mom, why are all our things packed? What are you doing? Are we moving? Your father and I are moving to Florida. I don't understand. Like, why? Because you and your friends decided to vote for a Muslim, Jew-hating mayor of New York. And that's why we're leaving. But what about me? What am I going to do? I don't know. You'll figure it out. You know, you think you're so smart. You think you know everything. You voted for a socialist who's going to take all our money and give it to the homeless and anybody else who they wanted to give it to. And we're just not going to be a part of it. We're not staying here for that. You do what you want. You live off the food stamps in the government and do whatever you think is best. Could I still live in this beautiful apartment in New York City? That's hilarious. On your salary? No, you're not living in our apartment, okay? You're going to have to live on your own. And also, you're out of our will.
Well, as always, we thank all of you for sharing Saturday mornings with us. For David Hensley, I'm Steve Woodward. We're back next Saturday exposing deception, corruption, and rhino imposters doing what we do best, taking aim.